Hello and welcome to the No Ceilings NBA Draft Show. Today is a deep dives episode. I am your co-host Nick Agar Johnson, and here as always with my other co-host Paige Otto. Paige, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. There's one thing that is weighing on my mind, which you already know, which is in theory I was supposed to have an article out this week, and that has turned from a project that I knew would be ridiculously time-consuming to a project that has become even more ridiculously time-consuming. But, you know, other than that, I'm doing great. We've got some fun players to talk about today before we get into our quick hits section at the end. And yeah, you picked a player who I think is going to be a ton of fun for us to talk about, who has not only had one of the more interesting freshman seasons of any prospect in the country, but has also been much better in the last couple of weeks than he was to start the season. So always nice to see a player on an upward trajectory. So let's get into our Braden Burries discussion right after this. So, Braden Burries, freshman for the Arizona Wildcats. I'm just going to throw it to you to open it up on the floor. That sentence made sense when I thought of it in my head. Anyway.
I got what you're saying.
Talk about Braden Burries before I look even stupider, please.
Yeah, I was super excited to bring up Braden Burries. For those of you guys that are listening, watching, just a little bit background about him. Freshman, Nick just mentioned, you know, he's playing for the number one team in the country. The latest AP poll just came out yesterday. He played for Roosevelt in California. He was a California Gatorade Player of the Year. He was actually one of three finalists for the National Gatorade Player of the Year as well, five-star recruit. On the older side, as a freshman, just turned 20 years old, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. If you put that in perspective, Koa Pete, his counterpart in the 2025 recruiting class of 18. McDonald's All-American, played for Strive for Greatness with Bryce James, and obviously they're playing together at Arizona as well. He's a lot of fun, Nick. You know, he can play on and off the ball. He's a great cutter, slasher. Obviously, he's had some troubles with his shot, but he's a beast in transition. I think he's a ferocious coast-to-coast player. Love his footwork, especially around the rim. Great finisher out the rim. Not the most, I would say he's athletic, but he's not the most, you know, vertical athlete. But definitely, you know, he uses his size at an advantage. With obviously, you know, he's playing with Jaden Bradley, Koa Pete, Karchekov, you know, Dwayne Aristoad. A lot of great players at Arizona, and I think he's really found his stride. I know a lot of the guys at No Ceilings were super excited about him coming into the season, and I think I don't think he knows how great of a player he can become, honestly. Obviously, his playmaking isn't really there yet. I'd like to see that more develop, but with him, I think he can do a little bit of everything. Solid three-level score. I wouldn't say he's elite in that level yet. You know, he's a big guard. You know, playing against smaller guards, he definitely likes to play bully ball with them. Can kind of, you know, he's great at creating his own shot, has great shot making ability. I can't say enough about his footwork. He plays definitely older as a freshman. I would say he plays like a vet in that regard. I think we honestly have him a little too low on our latest big board. I don't know what you think, but he's at 33 right now. I have him at 29. Not too much of a increase, but I definitely think he's played his way. Obviously, only 8 games in the season, but he's definitely a first-round pick for me right now. Their next game, they play against Alabama, so I'm excited to watch that one. But yeah, I really like everything that Braden Burries is and what he can become. I'm curious what your thoughts are, Nick, about Braden Burries.
So I have him as an early second round guy, so pretty similar range to where we have him on the No Ceilings board. There are a few things that I think factor into my evaluation. And the first is one that you've already touched on, is his frame, which, you know, for the difference between him and Koa Pete in terms of age, it's really funny in the one sense that they are very much the same, is they are both exceptionally well built for players of their age and position. And, you know, with Burries, it's one of those things where it's always funny to me when there's sort of the conversation around small guards. And, like, yes, technically Braden Burries is listed as 2 inches shorter than Tyrese Halliburton was at Iowa State. Tyrese Halliburton was a much smaller guard than Braden Burries because Tyrese Halliburton had toothpick ankles. And
yeah.
Braden Burries is, like, he's built like someone who's been in the NBA for a few years already, which is something that I have thought about a lot very recently, just sort of in terms of how that impacts the evaluation. Because on the one hand, it's like, yeah, you know, the early portion of his career will be easier just in terms of him getting pushed around. The flip side is, you know, there isn't quite sort of the developmental potential of, like, I'm thinking of someone like AJ Johnson, where he was just so ridiculously skinny that it's like, it's hard to imagine him not putting on more weight because, and, you know, this is, this is one thing for me to say as someone whose freshman 15 became a freshman 40, but, like, no matter what, you know, just the most basic possible statement, right? Hey, if you're a teenager, you're probably going to put on weight between being, you know, 17, 18 and being 20, 21. And it's almost all going to be good weight if you're an athlete, right? Like if you're, and especially if you're a basketball player, right? Like, you know, there are baseball players who can end up on the heavier side and still be fine. But like the odds are if you're an 18-year-old basketball player, your frame is going to grow between 18 and 23. And so with someone like Burries, when I guess I would be a lot more concerned if he was worse around the rim, because the fact that he is a solid finisher around the basket, despite not having, you know, crazy vertical athleticism, that to me is a very good indicator of, okay, he's got the size and he knows how to use it, right? All very good things. If he struggled to score around the rim and was incredibly skinny, you know, that could be okay. Maybe this is something where it's just always going to be a struggle for him. And maybe once he's 20 pounds heavier, he's going to be fine because he's not going to get shoved around, right? So I'm curious for your thoughts, because I sort of, I'm weighed down on both sides with this, right? Of like, it's a really good thing for him to have right now. I mean, that seems like an incredibly obvious statement. The flip side is like, there isn't sort of the growth there just in terms of his frame of like, he'll probably put on, you know, more weight and more good weight over the course of the next few years, but it's going to be a different calculus than it would be for someone for whom the frame is such a concern, like AJ Johnson or Tyrese Halliburton back in the day.
Yeah, I agree with a lot that you said. I think he plays a lot bigger than, you know, his 6'4 size, but he's also, you know, 6'4, 205 pounds. And like to put that in perspective, that's the same as Caden Boozer. And I think Burries plays a lot, you know, bigger than Caden does. You know, he's shooting 63% at the rim. Only 4 dunks on the season, obviously only 8 games. But with him too, I think one of the most, you know, underrated skill sets that he has is that he is great already at, you know, following missed shots from his teammates, you know, with tip-ins and especially in transition too. Like for a guard, if you look back at the film, most of the time he's the first one out of the gates as a guard. And that just shows like he's just wants the ball in his hands. But you know, in high school he was such an explosive scorer. I mean, in the CIF Open Division State Championship game he dropped 44 points, but he also shot, you know, less than 30% from 3-2 over his high school career. But you know, he plays so much bigger than what he is, but he still has that stocky, you know, built frame, kind of like, you know, Jared McCain did too, that, you know, we talked about a lot you know, a couple years ago. But yeah, with him, I think, you know, cause he is playing with such elite level players and, you know, that multiple, you know, first round draft picks, I really still like Jaden Bradley, as a point guard, and obviously Coa Pete. I mean, the first game against Florida, you know, people are like, why isn't Coa Pete number one, you know, and all this, but,
people are always going to say that. It's like, anytime I remember the Kendall Brown era. I do. It was not a good time for draft scouts.
Yeah, and speaking of, you know, that trio, you know, Jaden Bradley, Braden Burries, and Coa Pete, I did see something on Twitter from College Basketball Analytics, the three-player combo of Bradley, Burries, and let me see. Oh, it wasn't Pete. It was Kriva. They were the 6th best trio player combo in the country, with a plus 58 net rating and over 133.4 offensive net rating as well. Which, just to, you know, put in perspective too, the number one was obviously the trio of, you know, the Iowa State trio of Tamian Lipsey and obviously Mylan and obviously Josh as well. So Pretty cool stat. Shout out to College Basketball Analytics. But I think, you know, with Braden Burris too, I think he's put on more display of what he can do, especially off the ball, because he's playing with such valued players as well. And that makes a huge difference too. You know, if you're on a good team and you have the skill set that he does, obviously that's going to be amplified a little bit, even more. And, you know, if he wasn't playing, you know, at Arizona, and I think he would play obviously a lot more on the ball than he is, but, you know, you have Jaden Branley at you know, the one spot. And I think Burris too, he's more in my eyes, you know, a two guard. I think he operates a lot better off the ball. And I love his movement off the ball too, especially with Koa Pete too, right? In the last game they played at Auburn, you know, he had a lot of nice cuts. And Koa Pete, you know, having the playmaking vision that he does, was able to hit him a lot, especially on the baseline too. He's so sneaky on the baseline. And I think he, because he's not really a threat at the 3-point level yet, I do like his shot attempts there. I think, especially in transition threes, he tries to, you know, he tries them out, you know, but he doesn't really hit when he's wide open as well, especially in the corner. And I think those will eventually fall. But I know it's still up in the air because he's not, you know, the best, free throw shooter, either. You know, he's only shooting 68%, from the line as well. So that's something to, take note of too. But he's still only averaging, 2 fouls per game as well. So he's not getting to the line as much. I believe he's only getting to line, a little under, three attempts per game too. So, you know, he's shooting above 60% at the rim, only getting line 3 times a game. I'd like that to be, you know, get to line at least 5 to 6 times. But he's not the best free throw shooter either. So, you know, those indicators, in terms of the shot are a little discouraging, but I think he's just trying to find, you know, his way, with Arizona so far.
So I do want to dig more into the shooting stuff in a minute, but I did want to circle back to something you said slightly earlier of, I think the thing that stood out to me most on the film is just how much he's moving. And that's something that I think is valuable for all players, but it's particularly fascinating to me when it's someone for whom shooting is not the draw, right? Where it's like, yeah, okay, of course Steph Curry is moving around a lot off ball to try and get open. Like, you know, that's the best part of his game, right? It's like, yeah, of course, you know, I mean, a few years ago now, right? But, you know, of course, prime Klay Thompson was doing the same kind of relocation thing, right? You know, you can think of tons of shooters from, you know, less successful ones like Jordan Hawkins, RIP my Jordan Hawkins love from back in the day. But, you know, the idea there being, it's very interesting to me when a player for whom that's not sort of the main point, like that's not the main concept of what they're doing, and they're moving that much, because one of the things that I'm a biggest sucker for when evaluating a prospect is who can be a good cutter. And for me, that's just a very simple calculus of, hey, you don't have the ball in your hands. What are you doing? And, you know, for some guys, it's like, I'm just going to camp 27 feet behind through, like, I'm going to camp 27 feet from the basket on one wing or the other. And if the ball swings my way, great. And if it doesn't, I'm just kind of hanging around. Right. Whereas with Burris, it's like when he's in motion so much, I mean, first of all, that's a very encouraging sign just for the defense, right? Of like, hey, if you're in motion, right? If you're not someone who's getting caught up on screens constantly, that's, you know, a very good sign for defensive navigation. But it's very interesting for me on offense, especially for someone who, as you mentioned, you know, there are reasons to doubt the shot, but like getting backdoor cuts, as long as you're looking for them and in motion and you know your teammates are going to hit you when you make those cuts, that's something that translates to every team, whether or not the shot works. And like, obviously, if the shot works, great. That's even better, right? Because then teams can't just abandon you at the 3-point line and say, like, we dare you to cut through the entirety of the defense, right? So it helps in that part, but it's something that, you know, it's funny because the article that I mentioned earlier that I am nowhere near close to done with yet, one of the things that I'm struggling with the most for that is like, how do you put into any kind of model some kind of concept of effort, right? And it's like, you could put like who runs the most miles in a game. You know, that's some kind of calculation for it, right? But even just something as basic as like, you know, some players who maybe don't move around as much are actually putting in greater effort because it's, you know, someone who is stationed in the paint as a center probably isn't moving as much as someone who's on the perimeter even if the perimeter defender is being kind of lazy and the player in the paint is, you know, giving it their all on every play, they're just going to move less. And also, like, they're bigger and almost always slower, right? You know, just the most obvious versions of that. But with someone like Burry's, it's, I think, something that bodes very well for future development. But it's something that's, it's helpful now. It's more helpful in the future. And it will be most helpful if he can figure out the shot.
Yeah, and I think the worst thing you can do, right, when your shot isn't falling is just sitting there, right, and being stationary. And that's such, like, an obvious fact in, you know, the game of basketball. But it's, like, when you're actually in the game playing, like, sometimes you don't, you're like, oh, I should have, like, moved there and made a cut, or I should have relocated here, or maybe I should have, you know, did a brush screen or go screen here, you know, to set myself up. And he already, you know, notices that, like, in himself and in his game, and I think he's already, you know, taking strides of how I can impact the game, you know, if I'm not shooting the ball well. And he hasn't been, you know, a great shooter historically, but in terms of, you know, his projection, like, he has to at least be consistent there, because 30%, you know, isn't going to cut it in today's day and age. And I think you mentioned too, you know, he's great off ball, you know, in the half court, but also in the full court too, he's great. I mean, just how ferocious and, you know, driven he is to, you know, it's just effort, right? And he shows that every play. And obviously, you know, he makes mistakes, but he always has this sense of calmness too, which, you know, a 20-year-old freshman, you know, he's obviously on the older side, but I think that's, you know, a real skill, not just, you know, what you can see on the floor, but you can also just see it in every possession that he plays. And going back to the Auburn game, Auburn was pressing them, you know, he got the ball in the corner, you know, obviously the two defenders rushed over to him and kind of blitzed him, and he, you know, stayed calm, patient, and kind of, you know, split that, and, you know, took it coast to coast for an easy layup. So, I mean, that just, like, attributes to his calmness and the, you know, he tries so hard to control the pace, which I really like about his game too. And that just, that's just another factor that is, like, underrated by, you know, any sense of the word, but what I've just noticed in, you know, these first eight games for him.
Yeah, it's something that always stands out to me when a younger player can mix speeds. Like, you know, part of this is driven by the fact that, you know, one of the first players who I sort of evaluated from, you know, college film to playing in the NBA was De'Aaron Fox. And the thing that stood out to me the most his first year in the NBA was a combination of two things, which is, one, this is the fastest player in the NBA. Two, he has no idea how to do anything other than run as fast as he can on every play. He can't mix speeds at all. And watching him develop over the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 seasons was really, I mean, it was him going from painfully skinny to, like, viable in terms of his frame. But more than that, what stood out the most, you know, even beyond his shot developing, even beyond his defense getting better, was he used to have one speed and now he's got three. And it's something where it, you know, I'm going to go back to another baseball analogy, but it's like the difference between, you know, a player who can throw 95 miles an hour and a pitcher who can only throw 85 miles an hour. If the 95 mile an hour pitcher's changeup is 80 and the 85 mile an hour pitcher's changeup is 70, guess what? That's the same difference in speed, right? It's basic math. And so for me, it's something that I think about a lot in terms of James Harden and Luka Doncic in particular, of, like, you might not have the top end speed of a De'Aaron Fox, but if you are, I mean, when they did P3 measurements for James Harden and Luka Doncic, they were both in, like, the 95th or higher percentile in terms of deceleration. It's like, okay, so these guys can stop faster than anybody else, but obviously the best possible version is you can mix speeds really well. And you're also super fast. And Burry's is not a crazy, crazy athlete, but part of the reason that I love his mid-range game so much in particular is, I mean, you mentioned the footwork, but it's also just that mixing of speeds, right? Of, like, going from first gear to fifth gear, it's a change whether or not your highest gear is, you know, one of the fastest in the league. If you're good at mixing speeds like that, it just makes it harder for guys to guard you because they don't know if that's a hezzy or if you're actually just trying to, you know, get around the guy, right? And so with Burry's in particular, this is where I want to get into the shooting stuff because, and again, all of this obviously is small sample size because we're so early in the season, but he takes most of his jumpers, literally a majority of his jumpers have been off the dribble, and he's been solid at those, 53rd percentile per synergy. Jump shots overall, 28th percentile, and catch and shoots, 18th percentile. And that tells me exactly what you were saying earlier, right? Of, hey, this is someone who, and again, you know, the mid-range game is, and I have the question for you that I'm very curious about in a moment, but with the mid-range game, it's like, okay, so the fact that he's good at mixing speeds, the fact that he's, you know, good at taking smaller guys, even if it's not like directly in the post, right? It's like, okay, I catch the ball 15 feet away from the rim, you know, back a guy down once, hit him with a turnaround dribble, like, excuse me, turnaround jumper, that was English. But, you know, the idea there being that, yeah, he's got this really well-developed in-between game, and that is more and more vital for primary ball handlers, is being able to have counters when, you know, teams try and stop what you're best at, or even what you're second best at, right? So the fact that he's got that, you know, developed ability to mix speeds, the fact that he's got that solid mid-range game is a huge positive. The question I'm curious for you about is, how much do you think that matters in terms of NBA translation? Because the difference between how much that matters for a team's primary scorer versus how much it matters for someone who's lower down the pecking order is pretty dramatic, because, you know, the conversation about the death of the mid-range game is, I feel like it frequently ignores the most important part of that conversation, which is the guys who are really good at those shots are still taking those shots. Kevin Durant is still taking those mid-range shots. DeMar DeRozan is still taking those mid-range shots. What has happened is that role players are not taking 18 to 20 footers anymore. They're taking threes, right? And so with Braden Burries, I'm very curious of, do you think he has enough on-ball equity that will matter for him as much as it might for, like, Darren Peterson, who I think everyone agrees is going to be the primary scorer wherever he ends up in the NBA?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you could go yes and no to this question. Sure. And I think I'm going to lean more towards yes, just because of what I saw in high school as well. And that's because, you know, he you know, was a scoring frenzy type of player, you know, microwave scorer type primary ball handler in high school. But he's implemented other aspects of his game that kind of tell me that he's going to be fine, you know, stretching that out, you know, to the 3-point line. And, you know, he is a pace setter type of ball handler. You know, he's great with his footwork. You know, he has a lot of, you know, he has a mid-range bag, right? You know, he has the off the glass, you know, bank shot. He has the floater. He has the turnaround. He has a dribble jumper. And he also has a tight handle. And, you know, Devin Booker too, you know, Kevin Durant. Obviously they're way better shooters at the college level than Braden Burries was from the 3-point line. But they've kind of, you know, they're still taking a ton of attempts there too. And I don't think the mid-range game is dead at all. It's just not as valued as much, because in basketball, the most bang for your buck, you know, is layups and 3-point shots. And when you look at Braden Burries, you know, shot chart and synergy, right? You're kind of like, man, I don't know if he's gonna, you know, be able to do this, but I definitely think he can. It's just a matter of fact is, you know, can he, you know, just distribute a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, just more to his game in terms of, you know, as the season goes on, right? Because only 8 games, that's not really a lot to look at. But with him too, I think because Arizona is so good this year, I don't think we expected them to be the number one team in the country this early in the season by any means of the word. Obviously, Michigan's number 2 and State, I guess. State's 8, but whatever.
I was waiting.
I always thought Michigan would stay there.
As soon as the word Michigan left your mouth, I was like, oh no, here we go.
But another baseball analogy for you. I'm a Tigers fan. Riley Green, for example, right? You know, when he's going to step up to the plate, he's either going to hit a home run or he's going to strike out miserably, right? You kind of want a player that, you know, when they step up to the plate, can either get the ball in play or at least, you know, get some runners in scoring position, or, you know, have a, you know, high flying fly out to, you know, right field and like win the game for you, right? Not saying Riley Green can't, but, you know, maybe I'm just a little bit more of a Riley Green hater, but I think Braden Burries is, you know, that player that, you know, they're going to put the ball in play. They're going to get runners in scoring position, and you're confident that, you know, they're going to, you know, get some RBIs on the board and, you know, possibly win the game for you. And I think he's that kind of prospect. And what that tells me about his projection, too, is that I think he's going to be fine, honestly, as a shooter. And I think he's taking immense strides just from high school to now with the types of shot he takes, too, from the three-point arc as well.
Well, you mentioned layups and threes earlier, and there's a third type of scoring that is usually associated with those, which is free throws, which, you know, gets back to what you're mentioning earlier, right? Of given that he's got the both the frame and the body control to take a pummeling around the rim, it's one of those things where it's like, hey, maybe you should try and get more of those shots, because unlike smaller guards, you're going to be able to hold up in a way that, you know, again, there have been thousands of them, right? So like, name your crazily skinny guard of the last X number of years. You know, you're more concerned about them around the basket. I mean, not a guard, but certainly watching Jared Allen in his rookie year with the Nets is like, this dude tries way too hard because he's going to get broken in half, right? It's like, that's not a problem for Braden Burries. And so him getting to the line more, you know, as you mentioned, some of these shooting indicators are maybe not the best in terms of like how quickly he would be a viable three level scorer. He's kind of more in like the 2.5 range now. And so the easiest way to fix that, if the shot's not going to come around right away, is, okay, so just get to the line more, you know, because like, even as a 68% free throw shooter, that's still going to be more efficient than basically anything outside of a dunk offensively. So, you know, get to the line more and you solve a lot of those kinds of problems. But especially given how good he is with controlling pace and the stuff he does off the dribble, like, those are in theory the more complicated looks. So, you know, if he can sort of get to a place where he's more comfortable with catch and shoot stuff, then that would be a huge boost. And, you know, as sort of mentioned up top very briefly, but I think it's worth going back to, arguably his best three games of the season have been his last three games. So, you know, that's always something that you want to see with any player, but particularly when it's a freshman who, by definition, your sample size is their freshman year and that's it in terms of the college level, right? It's very nice to see, you know, okay, as the competition level is ramping up, it's not just, you know, and I feel mean doing this, but it's like back to the Kendall Brown thing, right? Of like, okay, you beat up on, you know, and Arizona's a bit of a different ballgame than, you know, some other college teams. But it's like, if you're beating up on, you know, mid-major and below teams, and then conference play hits and you're doing worse, that's not a good sign, right? So we're not exactly in conference play yet, but the fact that Braden Burries' best games have been his most recent ones, it's always a nice sign, but it's especially nice to me when it's a freshman, because then rather than that being, hey, this guy's off to a hot start, it can be, hey, the game was really fast and he's starting to adjust.
Yeah. And the reason I brought up Auburn, obviously it's the most recent game, but it was also his best game against actually top 25 competition, because, right, you know, Florida first game of the season wasn't the best, you know, UConn, and then obviously against Denver and Norfolk State, you know, were obviously his better ones, but obviously against, you know, mid-major competition. So take that with a grain of salt. So I was really happy to see, you know, he continue that, you know, positive trajectory over the last three games too.
Shall we move on to player number two here?
Yeah, let's do it.
So a very, very different kind of player here. We're not picking the same kind of players this week as we have in some previous weeks, arguably. But I went with Dylan Mitchell for today. And I was telling you this in minor detail before we hit record, but I don't think that there has been a player who has occupied more distinct spots on my board over the last 4 years than Dylan Mitchell, because I can say right now that he has been everywhere from fourth on my board to 61st on my board, and a whole lot of different spots in between, because he has had a very, very interesting college basketball career. So with Dylan Mitchell, I mean, the thing that jumps off the page is he's an elite athlete. This is something where I think Amen Thompson is the 100th percentile athlete in the NBA, and Asar Thompson is the 99th percentile, and everybody else is, you know, somewhere in that mix. Dylan Mitchell is not a Thompson twin kind of athlete, but he's, even at the NBA level, I'm pretty confident that he's a 90th to 95th percentile athlete. Just, you know, he's 6'9", but he moves exceptionally well, ridiculous vertically. He will throw down some of the wildest dunks you've ever seen. He's also developed in a very interesting way where over the course of his 4 years in college and three different schools in college, he's gotten much better as a playmaker, honestly, on both ends of the court, but particularly in terms of his passing and his handle. He's always had a decent handle for his size, but it's gotten to the point where I would say he has a good handle for his size now. And there were moments his freshman year at Texas in particular where he did not look particularly comfortable with the ball in his hands. The flip side is the very obvious developmental areas for him have not come around. I mean, you know, he's still, for his college career, I think he's technically above 50% from the line at this point, but like that's the kind of realm we're dealing with. And so on the one hand, yeah, he's shooting 70 something percent from the field this season. Let me double check that, but very, very high percentage from the field. And he has missed the three pointers that he's taken. And, you know, so that has dipped him to like below 70% technically overall. But, you know, that's been the case with him from day one of just, 76% from 2-point range, 76.6%. So, you know, you get the idea, right? And he's always been a ferocious competitor on the glass. And the fact that he's improved so much as a playmaker is fascinating. The fact that he's come off the bench for St. John's when he hadn't in his entire college career prior and is having his best scoring season and his most efficient season of his college career is very interesting to me. But it's one of those things where, he is technically below 50% for his college career, 49.1% from the free throw line. So yikes. But the thing with Dylan Mitchell that stands out to me and why I've never sort of fully dropped him out of draft contention, even when he really, really struggled at times last year with Cincinnati, is the things that he's good at and does well, he's spectacular. Like, he is a spectacular athlete. He, you know, again, hard to beat 76.6% from the field, right? In fact, he's leading the Big East in 2-point percentage, which is entirely unsurprising. And it's something where I think quite a bit about the continuum between Dwight Howard and Cliff Alexander. Of they were both undersized centers who were ridiculously dominant athletically. And then the question was, are they good enough as athletes that they can make up for everything else? And with Dwight Howard, the answer was a clear and obvious yes. He is going to be a Hall of Famer. He was, in my mind, by far the biggest snub for the NBA 75 at 75 list. You know, all NBA 5 years in a row, defensive player of the year, three times. Either way, there's a big difference between Dwight Howard and Cliff Alexander, who was a top pick in his high, like top projected pick in his high school class, showed up at Kansas, couldn't dominate athletically the same way, and basically fell off the radar almost immediately. And so for me, the question with Dylan Mitchell is he close enough to the Thompson twin level, or is he Hamidou Diallo? And I'm really not sure.
Yeah, I think with Dylan Mitchell, I think he's put us through every emotion possible over the past 4 years. Because, you know, you want to love him, but you're kind of like always a little like disappointed. It's like kind of like, you know, it's like growing up, you want this like awesome thing for Christmas. Like you want the newest, best thing. Like say it's like the new iPod, right? And your parents get you, you know, the last version of the iPod, not the version you wanted, but you're still hoping,
this is clearly the difference in how old we are. Just, I'm not going to clarify that point further, but go on.
Yeah. And for that point too, you know, he's back to playing as, you know, Mont Vert, you know, Dylan Mitchell. And I think St. John's is the absolute best fit, best case scenario for him. And I think Rick Pitino has kind of brought that, you know, Dylan Mitchell back. And I think he is thriving here. You mentioned, you know, his playmaking ability over the years. You know, he's an undersized center, you know, 6'9", 210 pounds, but he's going to be most utilized as, you know, a key connector at the NBA level with his elite athleticism. You know, he can take the ball off the floor now, and you're not like biting your fingernails like, oh my God, like get the ball away from him.
Pass, please.
yeah, exactly. And you're you know, you trust him to do that. You know, he can also defend at a very high level. He can play make for others. He can finish through contact. You know, he's finishing, you know, above 70% at the rim, you know, career wise. And I think with him too, you know, this is the first year he hasn't started, right? But he's also making the most impact that he's ever had. Obviously, you know, he's playing behind Bryce Hopkins and obviously Ejiofor as well. But with him too, I think it's just a matter of like, can he show just anything shot wise at all? And you know, over the years, it's, you know, it kind of makes me nervous because, you know, last year at Cincy was his best year, at the 3-point line. You know, he shot triple that he did in his first 2 years at Texas. He was 10 of 34 from the 3-point line, 29.4%. Obviously, he's 0 for 5, from beyond the arc this year. Free throw percentage wise, you know, he last year at Cincy, 30 for 76 at a 39.5% clip. This year, you know, 12 for 22 at the line. That needs to be way better. And I talked to Nick, you know, before, you know, we went live, but a lot of his free throw attempts, for those that, you know, have played basketball, there's this, you know, your coaches have probably mentioned this. It's like when you're at the line, you know, look at the back of the rim. Don't look directly at the ball. It's just an old saying, right? Mostly every, you know, free throw shot I've seen from him, he's looking at the ball way too long there. And you kind of, you know, brought up the Dwight Howard, you know, reference too, that I forget how many he hit, you know, in just like a practice setting, like at a, like a 80% clip or, you know, whatever you said.
80, yeah. 82, something
so
like that.
So it could be, you know, a pressure thing or, you know, whatever the case may be. But definitely, you know, his shot has not really changed over the years either. You know, he still looks very uncomfortable. He brings it way too far back. When he is open, you know, he just rushes consistently, doesn't really get set. But he's also improved like in so many other ways that I didn't really expect, especially as a playmaker and a creator. And with him, you know, that's going to be such a vital role because as the NBA, you know, was trending, you know, we've talked about, you know, Nate Biddle as, you know, a big man creator at the NBA level, like that role is being so highly used now in the NBA, and it's so valuable for teams too. And that's just a recent trend that we've noticed over, you know, the past, you know, 5 years, right? But I think he definitely, you know, he's operating at a, like a 2-to-1 assist to turnover ratio this year. He's had multiple games where he's had over, you know, 4 assists per game as well. And I think with him too, you know, I love when, you know, since his handle has gotten so much better, you know, he's able to penetrate the paint, and such because he is so effective around the rim, you know, he's like, oh God, he's going to either dunk it on me or he's going to, you know, do a crazy finish at the rim. But he's developed that, you know, aspect of his game where, you know, he's going to think, he's going to make you think he's doing that, but he's able to, you know, kick it out to his shooters on the weak side, find the open man like so much better than he ever has before. And that's such, you know, a mind, you know, I don't want to like swear, but a mind, you know, just boggle, you know, for defenders, right? So I think with him, he just had to show me like anything shooting wise, because I think he does have a good bag of tricks, especially in his post ups, right? On the block, you know, he has that little, you know, he can spin pretty well off the block. Doesn't really have obviously the turnaround jumper, but he tries, you know, here and there because he is so athletic, but you know, athleticism can only take you, you know, so far. But he is an elite athlete. I would put him and Cohen Carr as, you know, the 98th percentile in terms of athleticism and, you know, the top two athletes, in college basketball right now. But, yeah, a lot of questions, but if you're looking at, you know, his trajectory as an NBA player, definitely, you know, a key connecting piece that, you know, could be vital for, you know, a championship contender and any, you know, NBA team as well.
So in terms of the sort of direction of the league stuff, I'm really curious for your thoughts on this, because Something I've been thinking about a lot more over the course of this season, but really the last few years in particular, is sort of the notion of, I'm going to try and explain this as best I can, but separating positions based on end of the floor. And the best way I can think of this is Gary Payton II, you know, when he was at his best for the Warriors like 3-4 years ago at this point, he was essentially a guard on defense because he was their point of attack guy. And he was basically a center on offense, where it was like they would use him, you know, running, you know, baseline cuts and like being in the dunker spot and the kinds of roles that you normally associate with centers. And I'm wondering if Dylan Mitchell is someone who makes most sense as a forward offensively, or excuse me, as a center offensively, but more as a forward defensively, because what he's done this year at St. John's that is a serious improvement over previous years is some of the defensive playmaking stuff. And that's something where I think of, you know, the obvious example is Miami Heat LeBron James, of like, okay, I'm not particularly guarding one guy on defense. It's like four players are man to man and I'm just sort of roaming and I'm just, you know, going to where I'm needed most. And to be that kind of player, you need to be big enough to cover centers and athletic enough to switch onto guards when you need to. And that is a very small population of players that can fit that mold. And Dylan Mitchell can fit that mold. And so that's the kind of thing where if you surround him with enough shooting, can he generate enough offense essentially purely out of the dunker spot to get onto the floor and then, you know, show what he can do on the defensive end? Because even though it's kind of a, I mean, it's a less weird thing with Dylan Mitchell than it was with Gary Payton II or Bruce Brown, you know, the idea of, okay, so this 6'4 dude can't really shoot, so, you know, let's figure out a role offensively that makes sense. With Dylan Mitchell, you know, he's 6'8", 6'9", and, you know, especially against smaller centers, he can be fine, he can hold up, but I'm wondering if, and again, because most of the offensive stuff, except for the shooting, is really good, and the shooting is just an absolute disaster, I'm wondering if it's the kind of thing where a team that can afford to have him play his best defense sort of as more of a roaming forward, if they can put enough shooting around him where it's like, yeah, maybe, you know, on like maybe on the, you know, starter sheet. And I don't think he's necessarily going to be a starter, but like theoretically, right? Like, okay, he's listed at power forward in the starting lineup, but realistically he's sort of a power forward defensively, but is essentially filling the center role on offense because he's only 6'8", 6'9", but he's athletic enough that he can make up for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think definitely as like a roaming four is definitely what I would like categorize like himself in, just because, you know, his size is kind of like, if you're looking solely just at his size, it's kind of like, okay, what do I do with this guy? Right. And I think as basketball trends to, you know, we're playing five out more than ever, I think he's the perfect prospect for that type of role, just because he can do a lot, you know, off the ball, right? And with him too, he opens up so much more when you, you know, have shooters around him. Obviously, Ian Jackson, we talked about him super early in the season. He's kind of, you know, gone up and down this season with St. John's, right? And that hasn't had, you know, quite the success as a shooter. But with Dylan Mitchell, you know, playing around shooters, I think if he was to go, you know, to one of the best, you know, shooting teams in the league, he would definitely see the most, you know, bang for his buck there. But I think definitely, you know, he's not going to be a starter. You know, he's definitely going to be a high energy type player. And I think he has an insane motor too. And I think he's had a pretty rough, you know, college career, right? You know, freshman year, sophomore year, a lot of people thought he could be a first round pick. I know a lot of, yeah, I was right there with you. I was right there with you. And I know a lot of guys from No Ceilings too were. And I think, you know, you start your college career on such a high note and you don't live up to those expectations. And, you know, you transfer to this school, you transfer to that school, but it's definitely, you know, he's 23 already. And I think with him, there's not as much questions that I have for him in terms of his role than I did before the season. I think it's definitely, you know, gone down a lot just because of, you know, his playmaking ability too. And what you mentioned too, I do see him, you know, fitting in as, you know, that versatile four roaming type big man that you can, you know, play off of, and, you know, he can bring the ball up and set up a lot of things for you and set the table for you. It's just a matter of, you know, can we, you know, I think he's also going to be targeted defensively too, because of his size, and people know his game. And I think he's going to get a little frustrated at the NBA level because he's going to be going up against, you know, actual four and five big man that have, you know, 20, 30 pounds on him that can also shoot too. So, I don't know. There's a lot of questions, you know, if he was, you know, 6'11", one of the names that comes to mind is obviously Oso Iguodaro. Obviously way better playmaker than Dylan Mitchell, but can never really, you know, find a shot, from the 3-point range as well, but also could do a lot more offensively in the mid range than Dylan Mitchell could, right? And it was obviously more, you know, offensively skill set than, Dylan was, but, just in terms of what he can offer to an NBA team, I think if you want, you know, a high flying athlete, a guy that you can trust handling the ball, can play make for others, and can, you know, do a lot of damage, especially in the short role and in the gut, and play that two man big man game with the other big. I think Dylan Mitchell is kind of like a, not a home run pick by any stretch of the word, but if you're looking for a high level, you know, second round pick, then I think Dylan Mitchell is an easy answer for sure.
It's fascinating to me because the strengths are incredibly obvious. The weaknesses are incredibly obvious. And yet the sliding scale of how much each of those things matter is going to be so thoroughly dependent on which team ends up being interested. That's like, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we talk plenty of times about sort of avenues to playing time, right? And it's one of those things where, you know, when we're talking about it with Yaxel Endabor, it's like, where does this guy not fit? And the answer is, there's pretty much nowhere that he doesn't fit. With Dylan Mitchell, it's almost the opposite thing of like, if he gets to a perfect situation, then I think he could be a steal of a pick. The question is just, what is that situation? It's like, yeah, maybe it's like, yeah, I think he could be great in OKC, but it's like, who's not going to succeed there? Right. It's like,
yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, given how much they emphasize the shooting part of, you know, pass, defend, shoot kind of players, he doesn't quite have the shooting part, and the passing he's improved leaps and bounds, and the defense is, it's interesting because, again, it's one of those things where I think his best role is as a roaming four, but also, as you mentioned, the, you know, interior defense, especially against bigger big men, is going to be a problem, whereas he's exceptional on the perimeter for someone his size, which is an odd kind of mix to work out. And so, even though in theory the profile is incredibly straightforward, in reality, I'm just, you know, thinking through the different notions of, okay, assuming the shot is a lost cause, where do we go from here? And it's like, there are theoretical teams where he could make a lot of sense. Like, honestly, you know, if the Warriors had gotten him like 6-7 years ago, that's a real problem of a player, but they didn't get him 6-7 years ago. And so now it's like, okay, like, is next year's version of the Celtics with Jason Tatum back maybe somewhere that he would fit? Because nobody shoots more threes than they do. Like, yeah, I can see that in a way that, you know, really works out. The flip side, of course, is like, if he goes to somewhere like Orlando that has a ton of guys around his size and also desperately needs shooting, it's like, does he see the floor for Orlando? I don't know. Whereas he might on a much better team in OKC that is just better able to allow him to play to his strengths and sort of have backline insurance for his weaknesses.
Yeah, I think, you know, Warriors Celtics would kind of be the best case scenario for him. But the difference between, you know, college and the transfer portal is that players can kind of pick and choose where they go. But on draft night, you don't really get to do that. So I think with him, we're kind of leaning more towards, you know, if Dylan Mitchell, you know, goes to his perfect scenario, you know, he can be a home run pick, but that's not really, you know, reality. But there's a lot of different avenues where I think he can succeed, but there's also a lot of avenues where I think he can fail as well. And that's just me being honest too, which, obviously I don't want that to happen, but, there's just a lot more questions with his game. And I think I need just a little bit more, more from him this season to kind of get a clear avenue and not just tunnel vision of, you know, all the things he can't do. Right. It needs to, you know, I kind of need to go off the road a little bit. Right. In terms of, you know, what avenue he can, you know, provide for an NBA team.
It's the kind of thing where, you know, as much as he has jumped up and down on my personal board over the years, I'm willing to bet that he's one of the prospects who has the biggest spread between where he's ranked on various teams' boards. Like, could I see him being someone who the Warriors would consider with an early second round pick? Yeah, absolutely. Is it possible that Orlando doesn't have him in their top 100? Yes, also quite possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because sometimes the band is very narrow because, again, you know, I'm just leaning on him because he's the most obvious example of this. With someone like Yaks, right? It's like teams that, you know, maybe there are, you know, two or three teams in the league that just say he's going to be 24, so we're automatically out, which, you know, I've said before and I'll say again, I think is intensely stupid, but that's a side point, right? The idea being, if there are teams that don't have Yaks on their board at all, like, it's because he's too old in their minds. And again, I wouldn't think that way if I were an NBA team, but I'm also, you know, not an NBA team. But, you know, the idea there being, I don't think that there are many teams who think, yeah, his skill set just doesn't fit with us. With Dylan Mitchell, that's very easy to see.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think another team that I kind of like too is the Bucks as well. I mean, obviously Giannis kind of up in the air where we'll he's see. Going to go. We'll see, right? You know, he's been making a lot of waves recently. Obviously, you know, there was hype around the Knicks, you know, during the trade line. It's going to be fascinating to see if he actually does stay or, you know, where he goes. Maybe the Pistons will pick him up. you never know. But I think that could also be an option, too, if, you know, Giannis did leave. Obviously, they have Andre Jackson still, which
right,
kind of, you know, kind of obviously Dylan is taller than Andre Jackson and provides a little bit more on the playmaking side as well, but in terms of athleticism, high flying ability, kind of, you know, that great motor and defensive prowess, they're kind of in the same tier, right? But it just depends on what NBA teams value his skill set as. And I think lucky for him, with how the NBA trend is trending, he has a lot more, you know, positive things about his game that NBA teams will like. Compared to, you know, 2 years ago where, you know, he was kind of like in this bubble of, you know, he's a high flying athlete that, you know, can dunk everything and doesn't miss around the rim and has a great motor. But now, you know, if you add playmaking to that, you add, he has a great handle now for his size, you know, you're looking at a lot of different avenues of where he can go.
Yeah, I think the good news for Dylan Mitchell, you know, as opposed to when he was in, I mean, he was the fifth recruit in his class by RSCI, right? From him going from that, you know, prospect type to where he is now, I think it's the kind of deal where, and, you know, there's technically an unlimited amount of stupidity that could potentially fall on NBA teams. But, like, I'm willing to bet that whichever team drafts Dylan Mitchell will be a team that thinks he can fit in with their system. Like, again, you know, purely speculation, but the reason that I'm much more willing to bet that Golden State and Boston has him higher on their board and Orlando has him lower on their board is, like, you know, he's not a 19-year-old who's going in the first round. You know, he's going to be 24 by the time he plays his first NBA game. And so if you're a team that can't use him, there isn't really a pressure to draft him. Whereas, you know, if he, I mean, given how rough his freshman year was in certain aspects, he probably still wouldn't have gone in the first round if he declared. But, you know, in theory, that kind of version of things, right? Like, he might have ended up on a spot where a team's just like, yeah, we can figure out the shot. He's only 19. It's fine. It'll come around. And now I think because he has had this weird mix of growing in some really key areas, not growing in more key areas, but also being the same ridiculous athlete that he's always been, I think teams are just going to have a better handle on who he is as a player, who he's likely to become as a player. Because, you know, it's something where I've brought up the Derek Williams principle time and time again of, like, you know, if you have a really, really small sample size of shooting and you can convince yourself that a guy is a shooter, that's a different calculus than it's pretty clear at this point that Dylan Mitchell is not going to shoot in any real sort of way. And so then the question becomes, okay, is he good enough at all the other stuff to be worth it for us? And I think the answer is going to be there are only a few NBA teams for whom that's the case. And I would certainly say that those NBA teams should be very interested because there is an easy to see version of Dylan Mitchell that is a really valuable bench player in my mind anyway. And so then the question is, if he goes to one of those teams, odds are that he'll outperform his draft slot because he'll end up going later in the second round to a team that can really use him, as opposed to, you know, ending up on a team that's like, oh, shot. Oh, but if only we could figure out the shot, right? It's like, given that that ship has already sailed at this point, I think the number of teams that are going to be bidding for Dylan Mitchell, odds are good in my mind that those are going to be the teams that make sense for Dylan Mitchell.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. You've kind of like changed my mind a little bit heading into this episode. I'm a little bit more positive.
That's nice.
It doesn't happen too often, I guess. But
I was going to say the flip side is I moved Donovan Dent about 10 spots up my board after we talked about him because I had a very similar sort of thing of like, wait, why am I ranking him so much higher than Mobley? I don't think I should be doing that. So there you go. We're changing each other's minds. It's a good thing.
That's what we're here for.
There you go.
That's what we're here for, Nick. Yeah, let's move on.
Let's move on to our quick hits and close this out. All right, so let's go into our quick hits here. You wanted to talk about the slate for tonight?
Yeah, a couple games on this Tuesday night. Not as good of a slate as last week, but still some games worth mentioning. Got Clemson BYU. That has been delayed. Not sure why, but just check that. Maybe a clock issue or, you know, who knows. But Villanova, Michigan. Michigan's beating another team by a little less than 40 points. Shocker. That seems like to be quite the norm for them. But just to check on our guy, Yaks, 9 points, 2 of 6 from the field, 0 of 3 from 3-point range, 5 of 6 from the line, three rebounds, 2 assists, 4 steals. So
casual 4 steals.
Yeah. So another, you know, stat line where, you know, shot not falling, obviously he's making an impact everywhere else. So good to see there. Other game, Ohio State. Let's see how our guy Janiah Mobley's doing. 3 points in 13 minutes, 1 of 6 from the field, 1 of 4 from three.
Yikes.
But also the first quarter is just happening. So going into halftime, Ohio State's losing by 6 to Illinois. And then obviously the marquee matchup of the night, Florida-UConn at 9 p.m. Super excited for that matchup.
Yeah, we will be done recording by the time that game starts, unless something really weird happens over the next few minutes.
Yeah.
So I sort of sprinkled throughout the episode today mentions to this mammoth of an article that I'm working on. And I sort of mentioned last week that I had made the incredible mistake of watching every single possession of Nate Biddle on both ends of the floor. Mm-hmm. And so to rectify my mistake, I decided to do that for 4 other players as well, because I've completely lost my mind. And so I watched every play for Andre Stojakovic. I watched every play for Miles Bird. I watched every play for Flori Bidunga, and I also watched every Donovan Dent possession this season. And the reason I wanted to bring up Dent in particular is I came away from that film deep dive much less worried about Dent than I had been going in. And the reason for that is pretty obvious, which is if you look at Dent's shooting splits right now, they're not pretty. He's shooting 7% on 3-point range, 36% from the floor. But I watched all the 3-point attempts he's taken this season, and this is something that I'm curious for your opinion on, because as we've talked about before, my athletic career ended in high school and yours continued after that. And you were also a much better athlete than I ever was, but you know, something that I do remember from being an athlete, at least at the high school level, is when you're hurt, you don't say shit unless something is either broken or torn, right? And so it's like, I was watching Donovan Dent's film, and, you know, one thing stood out to me, which is almost all of his shots were missing in the exact same way. And the threes in particular, you can, you know, if you can find the film of Donovan Dent three-pointers this season, you're going to notice the majority of the shots are missing in the exact same way. They're all missing long, and they're all missing to the right. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, very early on in the film breakdown, I was like, I'm pretty sure he's playing hurt. Let me check what that injury was. And I looked it up, and it was left calf strain. And at first blush, that confused me a bit. And then I realized, oh, he's overcompensating. His left leg isn't feeling quite right. So, you know, one of two ways that can go, right? Either, oh, my left leg is hurt. I can't push off as hard off my left leg. So everything is short and to the left, right? Because I'm, you know, I'm short on one side of my body. And the flip side is exactly what would happen if he was doing the opposite of overcompensating, right? Of, I know my leg's not 100%, but I get, like, it certainly seems from the film like he is underrating how close to 100% he is, because almost all of his shots are missing in the exact same way. And it's the way that would indicate to me that he's expecting less power from his left side than he's getting.
Yeah. I think we kind of talked about this before we started. But, you know, calf strains, hamstring strains, you know, groin strains is, a lot of people think it's like, oh, you just like hurt, you know, your calf. Like, it'll be like, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, but it's actually longer than that, just because your other leg is overcompensating for, you know, your leg not, you know, being, you know, 100%, right? So having that, it actually affects your whole body and, you know, everyday activities too, because one, you're kind of scared it's going to happen again. And, and two, it's kind of like, it doesn't really feel the same. Like, you have to do a lot of PT, other, you know, we see it reoccurring all the time. You know, Caitlin Clark had that hamstring injury, groin strain that kind of kept reoccurring this year. And eventually, you know, she was out for the remainder of the year. It's kind of like this nagging injury that if you don't heal it properly, it's gonna, you know, affect everything, right? In terms of basketball, everyday life too. And it's kind of a injury too that we talked about, kind of has been happening a lot more in every sport too. You know, Devin Booker, he's been dealing with that, Jalen Green. And I don't know if it's like, you know, have to get a better, you know, athletic and strength conditioning staff, or, you know, better exercise, or whatever the case may be. But yeah, definitely with Donovan Dent, you can tell he's overcompensating. And, you know, with Mick Cronin, you know, he's kind of the coach. It's like, hey, you're going to play through it because, you know, you're our best player and we need you out there, right? But that can also, you know, obviously hurt you long term. Obviously, if you look at it number wise, it's not the season we've hoped for with Donovan Dent. But that just goes to show too, you know, even Darren Peterson, you know, he had a hamstring injury. He's finally back. But it took him kind of longer than we expected. You know, we were excited for him to play in the Players Era Festival, didn't play, obviously made his return a couple days ago. But yeah, it's kind of just an injury that you kind of have to, you know, sit, you know, 2 to 4 weeks, even 2 months too, for it to really heal.
And that's one of those things where, and we, you know, talked about this briefly before we started hitting record, but even just compared to 5 years ago, players are moving so much more. Like, they're expected to run faster. They're expected to cover more ground. Both offensive and defensive schemes call for a lot more movement than they ever have before. And so it's one of those things where, if you think about it for more than a couple seconds, it's like, oh yeah, of course, this makes total sense. It's like, you know, even if players are, you know, technically playing fewer minutes, those are much higher energy minutes, right? Like, you know, for all that people say, oh, you know, basketball was so much better when it was more physical in the 80s. It's like, it wasn't more physical because, yeah, guys were getting clotheslined at the rim, but you watch your average offensive possession from 1980s NBA basketball, and it's four guys standing around and, you know, one person dribbling almost always with their back to the basket, right? It's like, yeah, okay, you know, maybe they're playing 38 minutes, but, you know, it's something that, and I'm very much not a hockey person, so I could be you know, completely out of left field here, but like from the very little that I know about hockey, I know that they have as many line changes and shifts as they do, because once you're on the ice, you're expected to skate, you know, 100% effort the whole time. And so it's like, yeah, okay, maybe NBA players are averaging 32 minutes a game as opposed to 38 minutes a game, but they're moving a lot more in those 32 minutes than guys in the 80s moved in those 38 minutes. So it's the kind of thing where it makes total sense that, you know, leg related strains are up, because there's just a lot more pressure when you have to run 10 miles in 30 minutes as opposed to 5 miles in 40 minutes.
Yeah. And I think too, like going off that point, is that a lot of point guards especially are expected to play, you know, you mentioned at that 32 and more minute mark, which is kind of like very like out there as an outlier, right? Than it was, you know, 5 to 10 years ago. And that goes with any sport, you know, soccer, not baseball, but
well, they have the pitch clock now. There are some pitchers who can't take 2 minutes to throw every single pitch anymore at Blake Snell. Not that I'm, you know, anyway.
Yeah. And I think too, like that just goes with, you know, overuse, right? Is I think happening way more than it ever has to. And that just goes to show too that, you know, it's such a funny thing, like as an athlete and in athletics, is that, you know, you always want to play through the pain no matter what, because you don't want to let down your teammates. And that's definitely probably a cause too for Dent too. You know, he doesn't want to let down his team, obviously his coach, but you kind of take care of yourself too, because those injuries will sneak up to you, you know, as you get older. I was telling Nick before that, like I strained my quad in kickball. You know, I'm basically a grandma now, but yeah. Well, that took 2 months to heal, but yeah, definitely.
When you get to the straining your back getting out of bed point,
then
trust
we'll
me, yeah, it can always get worse, as we've said before and we'll say again.
Yeah, but definitely overuse. You know, I think his numbers and everything will definitely go back up as we enter, you know, 2026 and everything. But it is a good sign that he is at least playing through it and not just, you know, not being like, oh, I twisted my ankle and I'm like, I'm not going to play for, you know, X amount of time. He's playing through it, which is a good sign, but also kind of like, hey, like, take it easy a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at Justin Herbert too, you know, he had hand surgery, hurt his hand, you know, had hand surgery this past week and then played obviously against the Eagles last night. And he was wearing like a kind of cool, like armor type, you know, guard thing on his hand. But yeah, obviously he's not fully healed. He just had surgery. But I think more and more in today's age, there's so many things that can help you play with those types of injuries, which is pretty cool. Obviously, you know, Daniel Jones, we keep on talking about football, but there's a lot of analogies there.
You keep talking about football.
But Daniel Jones, you know, he had his friends at Duke made this like specific leg guard for him that wasn't really a thing. I forgot what the company's name called, but there's so many other like leg sleeves and, you know, knee braces that can actually just form to your leg, which, you know, back in the day, it's like, okay, small, medium, and large, like pick whatever fits best. But now it's actually contorted to, you know, your body, which is pretty cool. And I think that just goes to show it's, everything's always evolving, especially in basketball with technology. But we've been seeing more and more injuries like this. So, something's, I think, has to change in terms of, you know, overuse and, you know, everything else.
All right. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap this one up?
Yeah, all good.
I think we got it. All right. She is Paige Otto. You can find her on social media at @PaigeOtto_. You can find me on social media at @NBAJohnson. And of course, you can find No Ceilings across all social media at No Ceilings NBA, No Ceilings TV on YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. If you've been enjoying the show, please be sure to leave a rating and or a review. 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars. Always much appreciated on our end. And if you are enjoying the deep dives portion of the show, feel free to reach out to either of us via social media or me via email, nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.